Welcome to the premiere episode of AIA New York State's podcast, EP Architalk. Now, more than ever, we want to stay connected and keep the architectural community informed. Our hope is that this podcast will provide an accessible and portable vehicle for content to do just that. New episodes will be released monthly, so please be sure to subscribe, rate, and review. We'd also like to thank the AIA College of Fellows for providing us with the funding for EP Architalk through the 2020 Emerging Professionals Component Grant. I'm Talisha Sainville, a Brooklyn-based architect and principal of my own firm, 464 Architecture. I'm also the current AIA Brooklyn Chapter Secretary, the editor of our chapter publication, Pylon, and now your host for EP Architalk. Some housekeeping notes for those of you who are associate members in New York State. We have launched the Burton L. Roslin FAIA Memorial Scholarship. Scholarship recipients will receive a one-time reimbursement for the cost of passing each single division of the ARE. Scholarships are awarded based on both a demonstration of financial need and the merits of individuals' contributions to the profession, his or her community, and or the AIA. You should have more information in your inbox or visit AIANYS.org for more details. AIA New York State is also seeking out candidates to serve on the board as the Young Architect Regional Director. The New York State Region Representative to the Young Architects Forum of AIA for a term of 3 years. Candidates must be licensed for 10 years or less. Interested candidates should contact AIA New York State. Check the show notes for contact information. We have a great episode in store for you. Today's guest is Ryan Gann, Associate AIA of AIA Chicago. Ryan was recently elected to the AIA Board of Directors as an at-large director. Ryan is no stranger to the proverbial table. And today, we will be discussing how you can get a seat at that table. Now let's talk. Welcome, Ryan.
Thanks for having me. This is very exciting. Such an honor to be here on your inaugural episode.
It's an honor to have you. So what's the weather like in Chicago?
You know, it's very sunny and we're getting to about 60 degrees, which I'm very eager for because it was getting very cold. And there's a lot going on in the world, and I just want to be outside these days.
Indeed, I agree. So why don't we get started, Ryan? Why don't you tell us a little something about yourself? Are you originally from Chicago? Did you grow up there? Where did you go to school? We want to know everything.
Oh boy, how long do we have?
As long as you want.
I am a Midwesterner, true and true. And I grew up in Michigan, actually. So if for those of you, look at your hand, I grew up right across from your thumb, right on the lake in Holland, Michigan. Some deep Dutch roots. And, you know, I never knew what I wanted to be. I think everyone sort of grows up playing with Legos, tinkering, drawing, sketching. Everyone sort of has that story. I think I went through a few phases of wanting to be a firefighter, a zookeeper. And then eventually in high school, I really had an excellent opportunity to take a drafting course. And although we were not making actual buildings or buildings that I would love to show people these days, I'm ashamed of them now. But, you know, that really taught me what design was and sort of the opportunities that were there. I also have to admit that watching MTV Cribs was a big inspiration for me. And I think that, you know, the light bulb went off when my mom told me that what I was drawing, which was like a fancy plane with lots of bedrooms and kitchens, she was like, that's what architects do. And I was like, oh, well, okay, I want to do that. So that sort of led me to my interest in architecture. I enrolled at the Illinois Institute of Technology and became a Meessian at heart for all of you architects out there, and never looked back. Still in Chicago these days, love this city, love the richness that it has, the neighborhoods, the sort of quality of architectural history that we have and the legacy that we have yet to create.
That's great. So are you still interested in zookeeping?
You know, I do watch animal videos a lot, so maybe. I would love to design a building for animals. That sounds fun.
Oh, that'd be interesting. Yeah. Do you have any pets?
I do not have any pets. You know, I grew up with pets, and now my partner and I are sort of on a no pets policy. We have to take care of ourselves first.
Indeed.
And that's already a lot.
Indeed. Where are you currently employed?
So I currently work at Ross Barney Architects. We're about a 22-person studio in Chicago with a primary focus on civic and public space. What do I mean by civic and public space? We work with a lot of city agencies. So we work with the city of Chicago a lot, cities around the country, work with the Department of Transportation, work on transit stations. So it's almost at the fringes of architecture. I think, you know, for me, everything is architecture. This microphone that I'm speaking into is a form of architecture and design. The building that we're each in individually is a part of architecture and design. And there's a lot of in-between in terms of infrastructure that I absolutely love working on. And part and parcel with that is a pretty deep commitment of our practice to engage with the communities at a very deep level. That design excellence is a right and not a privilege. And that through every scale of experience, it's sort of our burden as the architect and our opportunity, more importantly, to celebrate those moments.
That's great. How long did you say you've worked there?
I have worked there for, 6 years now, a little over.
And did you always have an interest in civic work, civic architecture?
You know, I don't know that I would have said yes in school. I think in school, you're sort of overwhelmed by the incredible opportunities or scared by the maybe hampering and like narrowing vision that some people talk about architecture. I always had an interest in urban design. And I think that that has sort of led me to my passion of sort of working on these types of spaces, whether they're buildings or whether they're not buildings. And yeah, I think that that's sort of been the intention behind where my passion has started to grow.
Wow, that's great. Sounds like you're in the right place then.
Hopefully. Just trying to make the world a better place.
Aren't we all? Well, some of us aren't, but that's a whole different topic.
Yeah, that's another podcast.
So when did you start getting involved with AIA?
Oh boy. Okay. Well, that's going to be a whole history lesson.
We're ready
too.
For it.
But I'll make it short. I think like many people that get involved in anything, it was someone tapping me on the shoulder. And I'll actually go back to my history as a student. Freshman year, you know, eager to want to define who I was and what I was going to be in this next evolution of my life. I went with a friend that I had just met to student organization meeting. And, you know, 30 minutes later, we had volunteered to be co-treasurers and were responsible for all the money in the AIS chapter. And I had no idea what I was doing. I had no idea what I had just said I would do. I think that that's sort of the beginning of it all. And I never really looked back after that. I found that through conversations, through elevating my voice and elevating the voices of my peers, that we could accomplish some pretty exciting things, that we would get to travel to see architecture around the country, that we would get to interact and interface with professionals in the city of Chicago, and that it was sort of developing this culture outside of the classroom. From there, I served on the AI Illinois board as the student director. I served as the Midwest Quadrant director on the AIAS national board. And so it all sort of started to lock into place that I found a voice and I found a really strong interest for rolling up my sleeves in topics that I saw could use betterment or a new richness of dialogue, particularly when it comes to a youthful voice, and have sort of, you know, used that since then, sort of brought people along the way. I think that that's a really critical piece of what I hope my legacy is as a leader at all these different levels, is that as I've left and moved on, there's been a new community that has sort of filled that void more than I could have ever imagined, with a new sense of excitement and eagerness to use the platform of this professional organization, the American Institute of Architects, to sort of change the world.
That's very impressive. And let me just ask you, how do you feel like you want, or can you give me some examples of how you elevated some voices while you were in school and in your early parts of your AIA career?
I think, you know, when I first joined our AIS chapter, we were like 10 people, I think somewhere around there, you know, we could count ourselves on two hands. And after a little bit of sweat equity, 3 years later, we were over 150 students strong, actively participating in events throughout the year, hosting bake sales. And, you know, it sort of just grew organically. And I always had an intent of focusing on the content of conversations. All of our programming was always meant to be something that was very exciting, maybe outside the box and tangible. And I think that I've sort of taken that along the way. So I'm very proud of the legacy that the IIT chapter continues to have. We recently had a member of that chapter who was elected to be the AIAS vice president nationally this coming year, or actually this year. The AIAS president is a graduate of IIT. I like to think that that's sort of part of my doing, but certainly not on my own accord. There were a lot of people that surrounded me and sort of helped elevate that conversation. I think on the AIA front, I remember very distinctly a conversation we had really early on with one of the staff members at AI Chicago. And it was one of those naive things. And I look back at it and I'm very thankful that we asked the question. And it was like, well, why isn't there a student on the board? Where's our voice? Where's our seat at the table? Like, we just want to play along. And they said, oh, well, that's a really good question. Let's look at the bylaws. They looked at the bylaws. There was a position description. There was already a mechanism in place to have that position exist. And they said, well, you know, there are other schools of architecture in Chicago. How do you envision that working? And so ever since that initial conversation, oh my gosh, almost 10 years ago now, it's been a rotating position between all those schools of architecture. And it's really been an amazing opportunity for the students that have served in that role, but also for the AIA chapter broadly to not just be isolated in its methodology and approach to the profession of looking post-graduation and beyond, but also bringing along that generation, which candidly, all of the things that we're talking about today, climate action, racial injustice, those are things that the next generation is going to mobilize and enact in a very meaningful and tangible way. Without them being part of the conversation now, that's going to be a heavier lift down the road, and it also could disenfranchise a lot of people along the way.
So it sounds like you're surrounded by a bunch of IIT alumni in Chicago. And do you currently take an active role in going back to IIT and participating in various things?
Yeah, definitely. So, you know, where I work right now, Ross Barney Architects, our design principal, Carol Ross Barney, was my thesis advisor when I was in my fifth year. And, you know, through that last year of schooling, we created a professional relationship and an understanding. She invited me to work in the studio, and that sort of was like a seamless transition. And luckily, she was still teaching at IIT, and as her schedule has grown and as our work portfolio has sort of called her away to other things, I've been sort of helping out on the studio front and had the opportunity to teach studio for a couple semesters in a row, which was really exciting to sort of be back on the other side of the conversation. And I was just on a studio review the other day, all digital, which is also just a weird thing to even conceptualize. I can't even imagine going through studio right now in a virtual world. And props to everyone that's doing it and succeeding and still finding inspiration along the way.
So, you know, now that you're AIA director at large or at large director, which one is it? Director at large or at large director?
I think it's at large director.
Okay.
Not sure it really matters. It means the same thing.
Well, what is one of the biggest things, the biggest shortcomings of EP representation within the AIA or even just across the profession that you feel like you want to maybe take on?
Yeah, there's a lot to unpack in that question. I think I'd start by saying that I recognize that I'm in a privileged position where I work right now. My experiences and my lived experiences are one of privilege. And I think that it's hard for EPs to carve out time to see this level of involvement and voice and participation to see that as part of their professional growth. The flip side of that then is to say that those individuals that want to do it and are very passionate, but don't have the support structure. I'm fortunate to have that support structure. And, you know, I put something like this, a podcast recording, on my calendar, and, you know, no one double asks or questions it. And that's rare. And I think that we have to create a new culture of understanding that work is not just the level of production that I can do in terms of a drawing or a rendering or whatever. That is one measurement of contribution to an office, but there's another measurement of contribution. And that's through being a public advocate, you know, talking about your work, talking about methodology, speaking to clients. That's one side of thing. But I also think that there's a lot that EPs get out of these conversations. I don't think I would be as comfortable talking about my ideas, my design ideas, my beliefs, or my hopes and aspirations as much as I am right now had it not been for the positions that I've been in and the platforms and rooms and tables that I've sat around. And I think that I bring that back in a very non-tangible way, that I've sort of absorbed all these things, that I've absorbed an underlying interest in what the future of practice is. And that contributes to all the things that I'm saying, whether I'm conscious of it or not. Talking to clients and, you know, representing our studio on that front, I don't think I would have ever felt comfortable doing that had I not started off talking to my peers, stumbling over my words a few times and sort of looking back at emails and being like, oh gosh, why did you write that? That's such a poorly worded sentence, right? We all have sure. those reflections and embarrassing moments. And it's just, it's a point of growth. So I think that's one side of the conversation, support structure and the flexibility to be able to explore and the value that you place on that, the value that a studio places on it. I think too, there's just a lot of competing interests when you're an EP. You're trying to figure out what you want to do, trying to figure out your way through the profession and all the opportunities that it gives you. For those that are on a licensure track, you're trying to take exams that, to be fully candid, I have passed more exams than I have, or I mean, I've failed more exams than I've passed. And that's tough. And balancing all of that while trying to like define yourself, trying to start a family, there's just a lot of competing interests. And when the system and when the infrastructure doesn't provide the support on the other end of the conversation. So you need your studio support, your firm support. When the profession isn't providing that support or the AIA isn't providing that support to make it easier for people to contribute, then we're sort of stuck in a pickle. And I think that that's a lot of the reasons why there are not as many EPs that are engaged actively in leadership positions. And I think, you know, the wave is coming, but it's going to take time.
Yeah, for sure. And as somebody who failed a bunch of exams as well, just keep on going.
Yeah, exactly. I have one left now, so I'm very excited.
Oh, wow. Congratulations. Wow, you're at the end.
At the end. I just took an exam last Monday, actually, and I had passed or failed. I keep saying I passed because yes. I want to like project that onto it.
Speak it.
Exactly. And then it will come into existence. Yes. I failed that exam 3 times and took it for the 4th time and finally passed. But I walked out of that exam feeling like I had no idea how I passed that. I was so confused and I'm not going to second guess it anymore, but totally. It is one of those things that it's a marathon.
Yeah, indeed. It's not a sprint, but congratulations on passing that.
Take your time.
4th time is the charm.
Yes, thank you.
I think.
Yes, apparently. Let's hope the next one is not like that.
Well, good luck. So you spoke a lot about having support, and that seems to be really, really important to you and probably why you won that at-large directorship for AIA, because I will say that I saw you on stage back in February at Grassroots and you were like a rock star the way that the crowd was cheering for you. So it was my first exposure to you, but I could see that you're a crowd favorite already. So why don't we talk a little bit about how you plan on telling, let's say, EPs or individuals, is there a way that they can become advocates, even if they're first starting out. As you said, it can be intimidating when you're, you know, brand new to the profession, brand new in the work world. It can be really intimidating to speak up and to sort of advocate for yourself. So how would you suggest that, let's say, younger professionals go out there and advocate for themselves?
Yeah, I think that that's an excellent question. And I think, you know, to your point about seeing me on stage, I think, one, I want to do the work. That's one of the reasons why I ran for this position. I have a passion for that side of what the position means. I think the other side, and it's not lost on me, that even being on stage meant something to EPs that were in that room, to younger professionals that were in that room, or to older professionals that were in that room. That is a very rare thing to see someone that's less than 30 get up there and participate at that level and have that level of vulnerability. Speaking of vulnerability, I think that that's part of it. Acknowledging discomfort and being okay with that. And I think that, you know, there's a lot that I don't know. And there's a lot that we all don't know. And I think that we sort of place that burden on ourselves as younger professionals of, well, I don't know what's going on, or I don't feel like I contribute to that. So we sort of shy away. And I think we just need to acknowledge a little bit more that it's okay to trip and fall on your face, that it's not the end of the world. And that I think commitment scares people too. And because this is all volunteer commitment, the fear is, well, I don't know if I can do that for X amount of hours every week. And that's okay. Just be honest, communicate. We're all in the same position. We all have ebbs and flows. And, you know, the other thing that I'd add to that too is don't go alone. I think find a friend, find sort of a peer network of individuals that think like you, that are at the same experience level as you, or have some sort of affinity that you can share together, and go together into those rooms. Attend a board meeting, ask to be an observer in a board meeting. You don't have to have a position to participate. Show up at a committee meeting. Go and talk to someone after an event. It can be very small things where you just have a reflection or a comment that could really speak volumes and could really change the status quo. It doesn't have to be big, ambitious, and sort of all-encompassing, glam, sparkle all over the place. And some, for some, that works. For others, start small.
Yeah, I definitely agree with all of that advice. I mean, as somebody who's not so young in the profession, but definitely, I always tell people, you know, don't be afraid to say something. If you, as the slogan says in New York, if you see something, say something, you know,
exactly.
Don't be afraid. And even if you go in, lips quivering, legs shaking, nervous as all get out, you know, just do it anyway. And then eventually you'll get used to it, and you'll get used to using your voice.
Yeah. You'll develop your power of your voice. You're able to turn that switch of the megaphone on and off. And I mean, let me just be completely transparent too. Getting on that stage and speaking to those people in that room was scary. I was shaking. I went to the bathroom like 10 times before, and it was terrifying. Every time that I do something, I still get nerves and butterflies and think I'm going to faint right before it. That's totally normal. And you know what? It happens to everyone.
Exactly. And you're still a rock star. So...
And you will still be a rock star too for our listeners. You're going to feel that way and no one else will sense it.
Right. The bottom line is that you did it.
Yep. Exactly.
Great. I love it. I love it. So how do you feel personally about mentorship? Was mentorship something that you had in your life? I mean, you spoke about your boss being somewhat of a mentor, or at least a guiding light in your career since school. So how do you feel about mentorship, and what do you feel is the value of mentorship?
I think what's really critical for everyone to do at some point in their professional development is to define what mentorship means to them. And I think that there's a lot of that going on, right? You have to define a term for yourself. That way you can communicate with others in terms of what it means. And I think for me, mentorship is less structured I hear the word mentorship, but I'm like, oh, there's formality to it. There's meetings, there's goalposts that you're trying to get to. And I sort of always defined it as just, you know, like a circle of friends. It's people that are older than me, younger than me, my age. It's the spectrum of individuals that I surround myself with that are my sounding boards. And there are people in that realm that are super supportive of me, like Carol, like Peter Exley, like other individuals in the AIA that have sort of been there as my champions and sort of just rooting me on from the sidelines and giving me advice. And I would encourage everyone to sort of think of it that way. Who's on your side? Develop that network of people. It can be people in the profession. It can be people not in the profession. But it certainly is critical because all of us get in our head and we sort of analyze things in a very different way. And to have someone that's outside of your daily experience reflecting with you, whether it's sort of you growing into something professionally or whether it's you growing into leadership, I think it's really critical to have those individuals on call to be ready to ask questions and debate back and forth the opportunities that you have going forward. Same thing about, you know, not going into a room alone, bring your friends. Same thing here. Don't go into your professional growth and development alone. There's a network of individuals there that are meant to support you and to give you the aspiration to be the best leader, the best designer, the best advocate, the best, you name it, that you can be, fill in the blank.
So it sounds like you're very big on community and gathering your tribe, let's say, pretty early on in one's career, even if it's school, like starting from architecture school or design school. So what are a few ways that you would suggest maybe, or that you would say that EPs and younger people can sort of start making those connections? I know you mentioned a few of those, like reaching out to people after you hear a panel discussion. Don't be afraid to reach out. But what are like some other ways that people can start doing that? Would you suggest like reaching out to different companies that you might be interested in and asking for just informational interviews? Do they still do that these days? Mm-hmm. I don't know. you know, just following people, like how do people sort of start to build their tribe? Can you talk a little bit about that? What you feel like?
Yeah. So building your tribe 101, I can see a graphic for it. I think that, you know, it starts small again. And I think that, let's say from the student perspective, that's your professors. That's professors that are teaching you actively or ones that haven't taught you yet. Chat with them. I think the AIS is an amazing network. NOMOS is an amazing network. Arquitectos in Chicago is an amazing network. And so there are organizations that have the infrastructure already set up on a national framework that allows you to sort of get beyond where you are right now too. That was one of the best things that I could have ever done was to get involved in AIS and to just meet students from all across the country who were having different experiences in school at different points in their pathways. And they sort of joined my tribe. I have a lot of them. You know, I just attended a virtual wedding for one of them the other day. I've been to other weddings of individuals that I've met from AIS. And my partner now I met in AIS. So maybe there's a bias there or there's some sort of theme. So starting there, I think is really important. The other thing too, whether you're looking to change jobs, looking to get a job, you don't have to pitch the conversation as that. Like, oh, I want a job. It can just be casual trying to get to know someone. Now it's virtual coffee, virtual drinks. But, you know, when we're over the hurdle of being locked down and sort of in pandemic mode, go and have a coffee with someone for 15 minutes, 20 minutes, pick their brain. It can be people that are sort of a stretch. And I think that there's sort of easy ways to look at this too, where you can say, well, there are people that I aspire to be. And then there are people that I think I can stretch to aspire to be. Reach out to them. They'll respond or they won't respond. And I think once you start to build that network, then you use that network to help leverage the next level of connections that you need or want or are eager to sort of facilitate. So that's sort of like the active ways of doing it. I think the other side too, and it's a little harder in a virtual world, but it is about being at events and just being vulnerable enough to chat to people and sort of introduce yourself to new individuals and not expect anything to come of it. I think the intention of expectation that everything is transactional in a way is not the way to go about building your tribe. And it'll just happen organically over time.
Yeah, that makes plenty of sense.
How did you build your tribe?
I'm still building it.
Well, a tribe is never done.
Yeah, exactly. I do feel like I'm relatively new to AIA itself. I mean, I joined years ago when I first got out of college. I was part of the student chapter at my school. And then it's only just about 2.5 years ago that I rejoined and started to get involved. And now I'm chapter secretary. So I guess I put all that, all those nerves or whatever else to the side to get to where I am now. But, you know, you spoke a little bit about getting sort of an outside perspective on things. And that seems to be what mentorship, you know, a part of mentorship to you. Would you suggest even going outside of architecture for architecture students, to find mentorship, to find their tribe members, you know? And what do you think is the value of going outside of it for people who don't know architecture and all the stuff that we have to go through? It can sometimes be maybe a little bit like, oh, you're complaining too much. Or I don't know if you ever got that in school where your friends outside of the school of architecture were like, what are you doing so much in studio, you know?
Exactly. Yeah, I think that that's a really critical piece. And I unfortunately don't have many people outside of the design world, and I wish that I had more. And, you know, recently, though, I've started to build that side of my tribe through some of the projects that we've been working on and sort of building relationships with clients and individuals that I've gotten to work with in designing space and community. And that one's a really hard one because architects are very... insular isn't the right word, but we're very clicky and it's generated from school. Yeah. And it's generated from that level of community that we have in studio. The structure of academia fosters that level of internalization. So that one is a little bit harder of a nut to crack for me. So yeah, I don't know that I have a good response to that one. But one example I will say is that we recently worked for IDEO in Chicago designing their new office. And they have such an interesting structure of design thinking. And IDEO is sort of structured on this idea that in order to solve a complex problem, it takes people from all different backgrounds. So they have, you know, mechanical engineers, architects, communication designers, people with marketing backgrounds, MBAs, all on a team that huddles to solve a really tricky problem or solve a really tricky prompt that a client has given them. And in working with them, I started to develop some friendships with the individuals that were part of our client team. And that's been really great just to hear another side of the conversation, even though we're still talking about design. It's just the design of systems, the design of experiences, not necessarily the design of a physical building.
Yeah. And I kind of think that one of the ways that people can sort of branch themselves outside is similar to what you just said about IDEO, is that people can get involved with their community organizations and sort of spread the gospel, if you will, about architecture and about what we do and about how our role can be important in everybody's life. And then you start to build, like, you know, your local politicians, your local community boards, things like that, as well as allied professions.
Exactly. And I think that the sort of piece of that too is it's not going into that again with a mindset of transaction. You're not going there to find a project. You're not going there to necessarily roll up your sleeves and work. I mean, you can be, that's fine. And that gets to it very quickly when they're like, oh, you can draw things. Great. But that's the part. It's just in being an engaged citizen. I think that we've learned that time and again in many conversations with what's going on in the broader world. And I think that architects are uniquely positioned to solve a lot of the pressing challenges that we have moving forward. We can't do it alone, but we've all been taught a very unique way of thinking. And we're all inherently, I hope, most of us are optimistic and are sort of looking at the world through a different lens. That's as easy as going to showing up at a community meeting where a new project is being presented and providing your own commentary about what you think about it. Talking to your alder person, if you're in a city, that's, you know, our structure. I've met with our alderwoman and aldermen in the past, and it's been a great conversation. Going to a city council hearing about something. Now everything is digital, so it's much more accessible too. There's no fear in that level of civic participation. And, you know, as you begin to develop those connections, those interests, and finding where you may want to participate, then that's where the level of engagement happens about how you as an architect can participate in making your community a better place to live through X, Y, and Z, or advocating for a budget item on your city's budget, right? I mean, there are very tangible ways that are easy in my mind that you could do. And they're sort of small gestures of participation.
Yeah, for sure. So start small, right?
Exactly. Start small. Be ambitious, but not too ambitious to begin with.
I like that. I like that a lot. So Shirley Chisholm said, if they don't give you a seat at the table, bring a folding chair. What are your thoughts about that statement? And how do you feel like we create the opportunity, we can create the opportunity to sort of bring a folding chair, to even get into the room?
Yes to that statement. Yes, yes, yes. Everyone should have that mentality. Like I said a little bit earlier, it's as easy as asking for the seat sometimes and maybe being denied. I think it's also just asking to be an observer. And I think that that's a very low stress way for the other side to see the potential opportunity without having to run through all the implications of whatever they're thinking. And, you know, if there is any pushback, my hunch is that it's not because they aren't looking to have your voice represented intentionally. And that's a very broad gesture. I think that there's a lot of unintentional gestures that happen when someone says no. And there's a lot of interpretation that particularly EPs have when it comes to that. Invite yourself to the room, invite yourself to the table. Guess what? The worst thing they're going to do is say no. And still, it's not the end of the world. And I think that that's sort of been my mantra for a while too, is, you know, the worst thing that's going to happen is no. And if you already know what the worst thing is, then, you know, there's nothing to be afraid of. And I think, you know, the worst thing that's also going to happen is that you have to try again. And what's so wrong with that? And I understand that there's repetition. You can get burnt out. You can get disenfranchised very quickly. But then I think that's when you go back to your tribe. That's when you sort of have that sounding board to re-energize you, to recharge, and to sort of really dig down into the meaning of what the intent is and what you're trying to get out of it.
Yeah, that's great. Remember that tribe. Remember that tribe. It all comes back to that, right? So what are some questions that emerging professionals can ask of leadership, if it's within AIA or even within your companies or state politicians, to help determine if a seat at the table is the right path for an individual?
Yeah, I think that's a tricky one. And, you know, I've had a lot of conversations in the past couple of years with EPs that are sort of ready to bring that their own chair if the seat isn't ready for them. And I would ask and encourage everyone to sort of look and see if that seat is really the best platform in which to get the work done. I mean, at the end of the day, that's what we're looking for. There's work that we want to do. There's progress that we want to make that we feel isn't being done or could be done better. That's sort of the subtext of a lot of requests and asks. So I think when you're having conversations in the AIA realm, maybe a seat at the table isn't the best and highest use of your time and your voice. Maybe it's at a committee level that's talking about creating best practices and policies that firms can use when it comes to equity, diversity, inclusion, and justice. Maybe that's where the real work's happening. And then that gets, you know, you have to sort of think of this the way that a lot of bureaucracies are structured. Is it's not just the boards that are making decisions all the time. There's a network of a lot of other conversations that are happening at the local level and the national level, and where a lot of really excellent conversation is happening. You know, you could look at the same thing. Go to your sustainability working group in your local chapter, if that's really where you're feeling passionate. I can guarantee that they're talking about something that's going to get kicked back to a board somewhere, or going to become policy at some point. That's where the real work is happening, and you can funnel up that way. Or if you're really there to sort of elevate the voice, be the person in the room that's saying, wait a minute, let's think about this again. Let's reframe the question. Let's step outside of what we know to be true about our experiences, and let's think about the others that maybe aren't here or maybe aren't present in this room at this specific point in time. There's also a lot of value in that. I think when you translate that to a firm setting, it becomes a little bit more challenging, because I work in a 22-person firm. It's a little bit easier for me to ask questions than it is if you're working at a big firm. And I think the same comments about the structure of the AIA, or any organization for that matter, it's the way that our political system works too. Figure out what the structure is of the place that you're in and navigate that. Use that to your advantage. And use that as an educational platform for you to get to the right individuals that can help influence decisions or bring and help elevate the conversation that you're trying to have. Not that many people are doing this, but when I was in school, I always felt like I was the one in the corner, like chanting for involvement, like, we want to be here. And there's a space for that. And there's a time and a place for that. And it's really important. I think the other part is to really dissect and sort of infiltrate.
Yeah.
It'd be strategic about it. And one isn't right and one isn't wrong. I think that they're just different approaches to engagement.
Sure. So it sounds like your bottom lines are find your tribe and then you'll find your table.
Yeah, find your tribe, find your table. Maybe you want to set, you know, try out a few tables. I think that's something, you know, I've bounced around a lot. And that's not because I am unwilling to commit to something. It's because I've termed out, or, you know, have found that I could do as much as I could do for that specific time and moment for that organization. And I think that that's also something that as you're sort of going through your professional and leadership life, that you have to be able to assess and acknowledge. Sometimes you've done as much as you can do at that one point in time, reassess, and then look to the future of where we go from here.
I kind of find that a lot of architects are interested in a lot of different things. And I think that that's part of what an architect is. You should be interested in a lot of things, you know, because that makes you better, well-rounded, more well-rounded. It makes you better able to design and to discuss with a bunch of different types of clients. It just makes you a more interesting person as well. So...
Exactly. Yeah, it's what I would call, you know, like the education continuum that we've been taught to always be eager to learn new things, and don't get disenfranchised and lose that too early. Don't ever lose it, one, but you don't ever lose it early is more critical, because I think that that's what keeps things interesting. That's what keeps us evolving, keeps our skill set growing and flourishing into something that's much bigger than any of us could have ever imagined it would be.
Well, that all sounds fantastic. And I can't wait to watch you in your new position as AIA at large director.
Yeah.
Yay. I should have had a bell or something like that ready to sound.
Right. Or like a little applause clapper.
Yes, exactly. So I know your time is probably limited, but I did want to ask you maybe just a few fun questions just to end this off. So we'll see how vulnerable you really are willing to be. I'm just kidding. It's not going to be taxi cab confessions here. So,
okay.
So, you know, one of my all-time favorite shows was Inside the Actor's Studio with the late, great James Lipton. And I love the questions that he asked at the end of all his interviews. So I want to ask you a few of those. What is your favorite word?
Oh, boy. Noodle. I love saying, like, oh, why don't you just go noodle on that?
I might start using that. I like it too.
Yeah.
What is your least favorite word?
Moist.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not architecturally related at all, but no one ever wants to hear that word.
Yeah. So what sound or noise do you love?
Okay. This is totally going to expose me, but I think farts are really funny. So any fart noise is going to get me every time.
Well, what sound or noise do you hate?
I think seagulls. They're like chatty and it just doesn't stop.
Yeah. And by the way, in my neighborhood, the Amazon Prime trucks now, they have these vans that come into the neighborhoods and deliver Amazon packages. And I don't know if it's a mandate, but the van backs up and the backup noise is the same as like a seagull or maybe like a mallard or something like that. Like it is the most annoying sound. So I totally feel you on the seagull thing.
It's just like a repetitious noise.
Yeah.
Like, okay, I'm over exactly. It. Stop. I heard you.
Okay. What profession other than your own would you like to attempt?
I guess this would be a profession, but I would love to be like an ambassador someday, like the ambassador to the UN. That sounds like such fun.
Wow. Yeah. And sounds very prestigious.
Yeah. Maybe that's what I'll do after this little stint as that large director.
There you go. You're already building your future.
Yes, aim big.
So Coke or Pepsi?
I don't really drink soda that much, but I would definitely say Pepsi. Oh,
okay, this interview is over. I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding. Do you have a favorite 007?
We were just talking about this yesterday. Daniel Craig. Daniel Craig, come on.
Okay. All right. I'll accept it.
He's just good looking. I mean, they all were, but...
Yeah, my favorite is Sean Connery. Not that you asked, but...
Rest in peace. Yes, he was good too.
Yes, exactly. Well, thank you very much, Ryan, for being here today and for talking to us. We really appreciate it. And for being our first guest.
Yes, this has been so fun. Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to see where these conversations go.
Yeah, so am I. And like I said, I'm excited to see where your at-large directorship goes. I'm sure it's all the way up, all the way up.
Well, you know, and just to sort of leave off on this note too, I think as much as we talked about reaching out as someone that people may want to reach out to, I mean, my door is definitely open. My email box is there. My social media channels are there. And I think that being accessible and being clear about accessibility is really important for leaders to make sure that, you know, we're here to listen, we're here to participate, we're here to collaborate.
Thank you again, Ryan Gann, Associate AIA, AIA National, At-Large Director. Thank you for joining us today on our first episode of EP Architalk. And for everybody listening, please stay tuned. We'll be having a new episode next month. Thank you.